This is the Real Talk University podcast, where your hosts, Andre and Christian, explore success stories outside of the classroom.
What is up, Real Talk fam? Today we are back with another episode of the podcast. I'm Andre Haeckel Jr., your co-host, alongside with Christian Bonnier.
What's up, everybody?
And today we have Pejman Gadimi on for an interview episode. He also goes by the name PJ. And it was really cool to have him on. If you guys don't know who he is, you're going to find out a lot about him today. But I'm sure you've heard some of the companies he's worked on, some of the things he does on social media, such as Secret Entourage. And he's just a beast in everything he does, whether it be sales, writing books, banking, so many different things. And I personally thought it was cool because he had an immigrant story coming over from the Middle East, similar to my background and my dad's background and my family. And he's just found success through hard work and taking advantage of the right opportunities. And I'm going to let Christian talk on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, a main some like theme of our podcast is how to find experience outside of the classroom. And for PJ, he showed up to college in a really nice car and the teacher said, "What do you do here?" And he goes, "I'm a student." And the teacher said, "Why are you here if you drive that kind of car?" And he goes, "You know what? You're right." So he dropped out, pursued a really successful career in banking. He worked his way up from nothing. He didn't start out with some privileged background. He had to come build his own name, build his own reputation through hard work, and he definitely succeeded with that. So we really hope you guys take a lot out of this podcast. So as always, make sure to jot down some notes. Reach out to us if you have any feedback or questions. Reach out to PJ if you really enjoyed his time on the show. And let's get into it, guys.
How's it going, Real Talk fam? I just wanted to jump in here real quick before we start this new episode of Real Talk University with an offer that Christian and I have put together for you guys. Basically, as a thank you for listening and tuning in to all of our episodes and supporting us along the way so far. So what we put together is the Podcast Blueprint ebook, which you'll have access to for free. Absolutely free. This is a downloadable PDF containing all the information, actionable steps, tips, resources, everything you need to launch your very own successful podcast in 30 days or less, exactly how Christian and I have done so. After reading our ebook, you'll be able to launch your own podcast today, book your dream guest for your interviews, and get ads and sponsors immediately. To claim your free copy today, visit the link at bit.ly/RTU ebook. That's bit.ly/RTU ebook. EBOOK. Get your free copy today before this offer expires.
Hey guys, how are you?
What's up? Great. How you doing today?
Good. How are you guys doing? I've been watching your stuff on Instagram. Interesting.
Really? Appreciate that.
Yeah, we just got off another interview, so just banging out a few today in between classes and whatnot. But really grateful for the opportunity to sit down with you, ask you a few questions. I've been following you for a little while now. Obviously, Secret Entourage and whatnot, some inspiration behind what we do. But my name's Andre.
I'm Christian
here at this Real Talk University. So we're just going to run through some questions and learn a little bit more about what you do.
You got it. I'm an open book, so ask whatever you want.
Sweet. So first, we're going to do a little thing called Two Truths and a Lie. I'm sure you've heard of it. Kind of cliche, but it really start off. So if you could just give us like three facts about yourself, we'll try to pick up the lie of the bunch.
Okay. So you want three facts. You want two truths and one thing that's a lie. Is that what you're asking?
Yep.
Okay. So one truth is I'm a really much... Well, let me rephrase that. I'm a huge watch and car collector, very, very large. And a lot of people who know me actually know that, but very few people who don't know me actually know the depth of the collection. And another truth is that a very few people actually know how bad, a lot of people know how bad the situation was when I first was brought up and came to America for the first time with my mom. Things were really, really a disaster. And we used to live in cars and things just sucked, you know, big time. Yeah. And then one lie is that people think I never went to college. So, and actually I did go to college for 3 weeks and dropped out when a teacher asked me what I did for a living because I drove a 911 Turbo on campus.
Oh my God. What did you tell her? Jeez.
No, it was a guy, actually. He just asked me. He thought I was faculty because I was, like, I look older. You know, when I was a kid, too, I looked like I was, like I'm Persian, so I looked like I was, like, 40 when I was, like, in my 20s. And so I, like, a teacher asked me, he was like, what are you teaching? And I'm like, I'm not teaching. I'm a student. And he goes, he's like, so how is it that you're a student and you drive a car like that? And I was, so I told him, I was like, hey, I'm working a bank. And he's like, why are you in college then? And I was like, I don't really know. I'm supposed to be in college. So I literally took my car and drove off the campus and then never came back.
That's awesome.
So take us through that job at a bank. Like, you were that young and you were already working at such a lucrative job.
Yeah. So I was an 18-year-old bank manager, which was the youngest bank manager found in the U.S. from what I know. I've never heard of someone else being that at 18 without an actual degree. And the way I got that is because from 14 to 18, I worked as a telemarketer, except I did really, really good. I did a lot of sales, service, a lot of management. And then so by the age of 18, I was already managing 3 offices and 20 plus people. So it was very easy for me to take that 80K a year salary and just walk and find a bank that had a 5 people team, you know, in a much smaller office than what I was already managing, and just kind of transition into sales management for a bank. And so I took over a small little supermarket bank at the age of 18, 2 weeks before I turned 19.
Wow. That's incredible. Like, going back to, like you said, you lived with your mom and you made the transition to the U.S. So my dad actually kind of did the same thing, but he was from Lebanon. So they had to flee from that war. So, like, take us through that experience and kind of like how it changed you as a person and kind of forced you to grow up pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, for me, I came from Iran, right? And from Iran, I didn't come to the U.S. We went to France because we're refugees, meaning we wanted to escape the revolution. So a lot of people in the Middle East understand that. If they went, they would either go to America, and at the time we wanted to go, America's doors were closed. So we ended up in France. And in France, my mom kind of started a business, took her 10 years to just make ends meet. And as soon as she makes ends meet, we end up leaving again. And again, lose all of our money to come to the United States. So we come to the United States with no money. And, you know, we have to start over again. And so she starts with the 10,000 she had left over from all these years working in France. She starts a restaurant and it goes to complete shit. This is in LA. And then we go from LA to literally we get a U-Haul truck and tow whatever we have all the way to Virginia to live in her brother's basement. And we did that for a couple of years while she worked as a cashier. Like, so this woman that was like top of import-export for a company like Lockheed Martin in Iran, you know, and works directly under the king, ends up being an $8 an hour cashier in her brother's restaurant. And, you know, I saw that. So as being a person that's like, you know, 15 years old, you're watching I was about 14 and I was about to turn 15 and I saw my mom just being in this position where I was like, that's not what my mom's supposed to do, right? Like, she didn't work her entire life so she can be a cashier taking orders for $8 an hour. So it just kind of changed me to say, whatever I have to do, I'm going to go do. And whatever that is, even if it's mow lawns, clean cars, do whatever it is I'm going to do so that I can help my mom, you know, one way or another. And originally I tried to get jobs, you know, even at 14 with a work permit, but it wasn't working because I didn't have a green card. So I couldn't work. You know, I didn't even have the chance to work, even though I wanted to. I went to McDonald's. I begged for $3 an hour to clean floors and toilets. And I was like, if you let me do that, I'll just get paid $3 an hour in the back end because I could walk to McDonald's. It was close to the house.
Yeah.
I didn't need a car. And I said, let's just do that. And the guy was like, I can't hire you, man. I'm a company. Like, and I can't get caught hiring people who can't work legally. So I said, all right. So I went around the neighborhood and I would wash cars for $5 a car. And what's funny is, I tell you this, I was washing cars for $5 a car, even when it was negative fucking 10 degrees outside. So the shit would freeze. Like, the, you know, I had the chemical, like the waterless wash, and the shit would freeze from the bottle to the car before it even hit the car. And I would still, I know he's laughing, but it's true, dude. Stop laughing. It's fucked up, but it's true. So I used to literally go and wash cars, and people were like, how are you going to wash the car? It's freezing. So what I would do is I would literally get them to take it to the local, to the close by gas station so that there would be a little bit more heat so I could literally wash their cars, and it would take me 3 hours to earn $5. But I just was in this mode where I was like, I can't afford to do nothing. So $5 for 3 hours is better than $0 for 3 hours. And so whatever it was, I committed to it until I was able to eventually con a guy at my school to give me a job as a telemarketer.
That's amazing. Wow.
It's reality. You know, I think it's something a lot of people don't talk about, right? It's the fucked up part of life, you know?
Yeah, and I think nowadays, especially just with, like, social media and all that kind of stuff, like, the true, like, work ethic kind of just disappeared. Like, people don't really know the true reality behind that.
Well, I think, you know, you talk about social media. I think a big part of social media is it doesn't show the whole picture, right? It's like a photo. Like when we think social media today, we probably think Instagram more than Facebook. It's more popular, right? And we look at that and we go, I'm looking at a photo and it's like this big, right? But what is the real context of even the photo? Take away like everything before and after and all the fancy shit. Just what is the context of the photo, right? Is it a posing photo or is it a reality of someone's life, right? And then is there a before and after that photo? Like what's going to happen once the camera is not rolling? What happened before the camera was rolling? And those are the things people aren't talking about, I think, out there.
Yep.
100%.
So was your experience washing cars kind of your first moment that you wanted to be an entrepreneur? Did you kind of discover that passion later on?
I never wanted to be an entrepreneur, man. Being an entrepreneur sucks. Like it's the worst. You have to outwork everybody. Nobody gives a shit about your idea. Every second you come up with a project or something and you're excited about it, nobody wants to buy your product. Nobody gives a shit about what your thoughts are. You want to save the world? They don't care. You want to build a product that's amazing? No one's going to buy it. You want to create software that's going to change how people do business? They don't believe you. They don't trust you, so they're not going to try. And it's like you could do the best thing in the world and you'd be pulling teeth trying to give it to people. So trust me, I didn't want to be an entrepreneur worth shit. I had to convince someone to pay me $5 to wash their car for 3 hours. You know what I mean? Like try to put that in context, right? And so for me, it wasn't even entrepreneurship then because I don't believe that's what entrepreneurship is. It was a job. It was like, I can't be hired, so I have to buy myself a job. And the job was whatever the fuck people needed me to do for $5, $10, I'd do it. And when I did get a job, I gave up on that car wash thing. I was like, fuck that. I'm not washing cars for $5 anymore. And I thought like, oh, great. So now I have a job. I'm going to make all this money. And then I started realizing that even my job had breaks, you know, like I had a 30-minute break, an hour break in between. And I used that break time to literally go back to washing cars, even though I hated it. I was in the same building. It was a commercial building. And I was like, I'm going to go outside, put flyers on people's cars and see if they let me wash their cars for the 2 hours of my work. That's how committed I was to bringing something home to my mom outside of what she was making, you know, just so we didn't have to be in that basement, just so I didn't have to watch her struggle in that way. Even if it was $200, it was $200, you know, it's like, it's better than nothing. And so, you know, that's that. And then after that, I went into banking. I got really good at banking. Like I hated banking too. I hated telemarketing. I became the best at it. I hated banking. I became the best at it. I got promoted, if I recall, like 17 times within 5 years to an executive vice president by the age of 23. I established airport banking for that bank and so much more. And then I literally get fired on my ass at 25. The difference, though, is this time I'm 25 and I still don't have a job, you know, like back in the day. The only big difference is, though, I'm not poor this time. I have a large portfolio of real estate investments that made me some good money. I had done tremendously well in stocks. I had a six-figure paying job with a seven-figure bonus. You know, so I had saved money. When I got fired, I literally got in my Lamborghini and left work. So it wasn't like I was like broke and like they're like, you know, like, oh, how bad, like we kicked this kid out, whatever. I was like, fuck you. Like who's got the last word? You know, I'm leaving a Lamborghini and you're sitting there firing me in your fucking Nissan Maxima. Trust me, like I already won, you know? So I left, you know, and I left that lifestyle. And you know what the worst part of being fired was? A lot of people say, even Marcus Lemonis said that, you know, you don't become an entrepreneur till you have a job and you get fired. And the reality was, I didn't even become an entrepreneur then. I just, the biggest thing that happened to me when I got fired, I had money, I was okay, but I lost one thing that I never wanted to give anybody else, again, the opportunity to make me lose. And that was purpose. Meaning, you see, I was a really good banker, even though I hated it at first. I became really good at it to the point where I would walk in the office at 11, leave by 4, and I had one of the highest loyalty index out of any bank anywhere for my employees. My superiors loved me. Everybody loved me. So the thing was, that was my home. That was what I did. When people asked me what I wanted to do in 10 years, I was like, I want to be a banker, the best banker there is, you know, and I was really good at it. The problem was now someone had said, you can't be a banker anymore. And there was no other bank in the country that was going to give a kid, literally, because the youngest person after me was like 65 in my same position. I was 25. No one was going to give me a job when there were seven jobs like mine in the United States for other banks. You know, it was impossible. So I realized then that either I had to go back and start from the bottom, like at least four positions back, or I was going to have to figure something out. And I didn't want to be told that I could try again, but only at the hand of someone else taking it away one more time. And that's what gave me not the idea of being an entrepreneur, but that's what gave me the strength to say, you know what? I'm going to find a way to create my purpose, not through someone else's empire, but through my own. And I said, whatever it takes, that determination will be internal. Because the word purpose was something I misunderstood a lot when I was a kid. And I thought it was a lifelong purpose, something that comes from the, you know, from a spiritual sense. It's like you found what you're meant to do on earth. And that's what I used to think before. And that's what really woke me up when I got fired.
Yeah, so like, how do you think of purpose now? Like, how does that like kind of affect what you do?
So I break this down a lot in my book, Third Circle, but it's the idea of purpose is often misunderstood because it is linked to spirituality and the idea that, you know, we have one specific purpose on earth. One of the things I've realized in my life when people ask me how I've been so successful, no matter what I did, even if it was things I hated, I tell them it's because I found purpose in everything I did. And I think if I can give one piece of advice to all these young people that are probably watching this, that are in college and they're like, you know, I don't know what I want to do with my life. I don't know what job I want. I don't know what business I want to start. Is that no matter what you do, that you're a cashier at a supermarket or that you're starting your own t-shirt company or that you're building a $10 million business at the age of 18, doesn't make a difference. As long as you can find purpose in the moment in what you do, you will be in a position to eventually apply that purpose to something you believe in that is greater than yourself. So I think the idea of purpose is not to seek purpose, to identify purpose and say, this is what I'm meant to do, but rather find purpose in anything you do. Because too many young people stop and say, wait a minute, like, what am I gonna do for the next couple of years, right? Like, how am I gonna plan my life? But they don't think about how am I going to establish my purpose today? Like, meaning like, if I'm a cashier, how am I going to be the best cashier in the country? Because they go, I want to be the best cashier in the country. I don't want to be a cashier forever. Why would I care? Well, reality is if you don't care about being a cashier today, then why did you accept that job? If you accepted that job, then why aren't you doing it to the best of your ability? If you are doing it to the best of your ability, then you're building character. And that character is going to apply to your own business 5-10 years from now. When people say, well, this isn't my business now, why would I work so hard? Well, because if you don't learn to work for someone else really hard when they're paying you, how hard do you think you're going to work when you're not paying yourself for 5 years? Because that's what real business and real entrepreneurship is creating change, right? And if you're creating social change, that takes time. How many people do you know are willing to work 5 years on something without a dollar in pay? And that's what it really comes down to, you know?
Yeah, that's so true. And not a lot of people are like willing to like say that or share that or like be honest and open about it. So like, and then you kind of mentioned like when you were doing telemarketing and banking, like you hated it. So mm-hmm. like obviously you're still willing to do it, but like how are you able to do it effectively? Like, was there like a time like when you were working and you just were like, okay, like this sucks, but like I gotta focus on being the best at what it is?
Well, I have a philosophy about my life, right? Which is that once we commit to how we spend our time, that commitment has already been made. So I'll give you an example. You commit to going to school, let's say 7 hours a day, right? Like you're in that school block. You've already committed your time, right? So that's something you gave up already. The moment you said, I'm going to school 7 hours today, you committed that time and there's nothing you can do to get that time back. So if you don't commit the effort to that same time, then you fucked yourself because you lost your time. So ultimately you cheated yourself and nobody else, right? Because you gave away your time, you committed it, but you didn't commit the effort to making the time worthwhile. And so if you don't have these two pieces to the equation, then you're never gonna make it, right? Because you're giving away the most precious thing you have, but you're not giving away the other half, which makes it worth something to someone. So ultimately you've cheated yourself. And I felt the same way about work. I would go to work for, let's say, 12 hours a day, right? Or 10 hours a day or 8 hours a day, whatever that work day is. I've committed my time. Now I can choose how I commit my effort. Either A, I go in and I put the best effort forward and there's a 1% chance I get promoted, a 1% chance I make a commission sale, a 1% chance I get some bonus money, right?
Yep.
Or I guarantee that I make nothing more than the basic commitment that I've made, which is to sit there. So if I'm already going to sit there 40 hours a week, then why wouldn't I sit there and actually effectively maximize my effort that I've already committed to my time? And so regardless of the job I've ever had, that it was washing a car, running a bank, running 40 banks, or even going as far as just saying, hey, I'm telemarketing, which is the worst job you can have, right? My first customer's name was Mr. Black Dick. How do you feel about that when you call Mr. Black Dick on the first day? And you're like, hey, is there a Black Dick home? And the guy's like, fuck you, man. And he hangs up on you. And you like barely speak English. And you're like, what the fuck? This is America? This is fucked up. You know, it's full of Black Dicks and no one's fucking picking up the phone. You know, like it's fucked up, right? So what I'm saying is, what I'm trying to tell you is that like, regardless of what the commitment is, if you're committing the time, you have to commit the effort to match that time.
Yeah, that's so true.
Right.
It's crazy to think about, but it's so true. Yeah, like, so if like, you're there, like, why aren't you like actually making the most out of it?
Well, because you've already committed it. If you don't want to be there, how many people complain about their jobs, right? How many people complain about they hate their job, they don't like their boss, they don't like this. But then you ask them, you say, okay, that's a fair statement. You hate it. You don't want to work there. Why would you make effort? I agree. Now, today, how much effort did you make in applying for 5 other jobs? How many people did you see? How many interviews did you go to? Like, if you hate something, then why aren't you in a rush to run away from it? So why are you still willing to commit your time and time again and never commit your effort, not even to the escape of the time, right? Like, you're trying to escape that time and you're not even giving effort to that. So then you start realizing that your life is imbalanced, and the reason you fail is not because your job sucks, but it's because you suck in your job, because you suck in your life. And so you'll never find success in your job if you can't find success in your personal ability to bring your life forward.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a fair statement. I don't get why people just grumble about their job and then don't do shit to fix it. But I guess that's just how it is. So, like, as you were
saying, so is life, right?
Yeah, it's not our problem.
Yeah. So when you were, like, saying how you're moving up in the banking world, you put a lot of money into real estate. Like, we're big into learning more about real estate. So how did you learn to do so effectively? How did you learn to invest in real estate, like, effectively?
So I didn't learn to invest in real estate. One thing I learned very early in banking was that banks were fucked and they were fucking people every day. Like, so I realized that and I worked there. I was like, this is great. So this is somehow people invest in this, and this is the greatest tool in the country is how they're fucking people. So I was like, how awesome that someone is fucking people publicly and everybody's participating. So I started learning how the stock market worked, how the banking world worked, and I started understanding how loans come about, you know, how mortgages come true and everything. And this was pre-economic bust, you know, so this was pre-recession, you know. So at the time, you had all these laws that had opened up that anyone could get a mortgage, which is stated income and all this bullshit. So what I did was I figured out how to actually not buy homes, because homes were overrated. You would have to wait, buy the home, sell the home, pay taxes and all that shit. That was boring. What I figured out was how the housing industry was fucking people. And what they were doing then is the builders were fucking people the same way the banks were. While the banks made it easy for anybody to buy a home, the builders also were making it very expensive for normal people to buy homes because there weren't enough homes for enough people. So what they would do is they would go ahead and open up these lots, which were like you buy a lot, you wait 8 months, and then we build you a house, you know? So it was pretty like easy, except that nobody wanted a lot, but everybody wanted a home. So what would happen is people would wait till these lots are built and then come there and be like, I want to buy a house. And they would say, well, since you waited 7 months, well, the price is $100,000 more now. So what I would do is I would literally go step by step to these places that were further than where people would buy homes right now, because they were just building lots. And I would pretend to be an investor, and I would buy 5 lots when I had no money. So I would buy these 5 lots with just $5,000, you know, meaning I had a normal job. I wasn't rich enough to do this. So I was buying $5,000 homes because I was just putting a deposit on the lot. The beauty of it was that I was selling this lot and selling it to someone else who was willing to pay $100,000 more to the builder, except I was selling it for $75,000 more 2 weeks before the builder put $100,000 premium on it. So I was undercutting the builder at fucking people their own way. So literally they were fucking people. I figured out how they were fucking people. And so I started fucking the builder so they don't fuck the people as bad. But it's still, everybody was getting fucked. It was great. Like, it was fantastic if you think about it, because I was able to sell and buy 72 homes without actually shelling out a single dollar outside of the $5,000 per home. But each $5,000 was bringing in an average of $70,000, some cases 150, some cases 50, but the average was $75,000. So you do the math. So suddenly I started getting really rich because I was never buying homes and I was never selling homes, but I was buying a piece of paper for $5,000, holding it for 6 months, then selling that piece of paper to someone else. So I was able to make investments in so many homes without ever shelling out a dollar or getting a mortgage. And so this was like the best part about the gig is that no home actually came to completion. So it was like the best gig ever until they literally put my face in a photo in the back of their builder stuff because they figured out my trick. So every time I walked in, like I would see my own photo and I was like, fuck, I got to get out of here because they're not going to sell me a home. But what was actually really funny is the first time I saw my photo, I didn't know I was doing something legal or not. You know, I thought this was like what everybody was doing. So I was literally walking in, I saw my photo and I'm like, shit. I'm like, I'm probably wanted by the FBI now to figure something. So it's like, I got to back up and like run away from this place. So I send my mom in undercover to be like, why is that guy's photo in the background? And they were like, oh, we're not allowed to sell him a home. And I was like, oh, thank God. Like I'm not wanted for some crime or some shit. So I was like, okay, I'm good. So then I had to find a new gig at that point. You know, I was like, this isn't going to work anymore. But I was already doing good in banking. So it's not like I needed money, but it was a good last minute strategy, you know, to get some money and just ultimately have a pool of money instead of just like paychecks, you know, no matter how good the paychecks were. Your lifestyle always increases when you get paychecks. But when you start stacking like bigger wins, that's when you start building wealth and you don't start spending the wealth, you know, because you can't spend it fast enough. If you're making $5,000 a week, $10,000 a week working, your lifestyle matches what your work is. But if you're making 100, 200, 300K commission checks all of a sudden, well, that's a different game. You know, you don't know what to do with it. You're like, I can't buy a new home every week, you know, to spend that money. So just keep stacking in savings and your lifestyle's covered.
That's such a shitty problem. Like, I would hate to have that.
I'm telling you, dude, the moment you learn how to stack large wins while creating process for smaller wins is the day you start realizing that $1 million is almost fucking nothing. Like, you'll piss it away in no time.
Wow. Yeah. It's just crazy to think about, like, obviously not being able in that situation before, but like so many people talk about that. So it's interesting. So
it's very easy, man. Money is the byproduct of effort and talent. It has nothing to do with how big it, like when you don't believe you can make $1 million, you'll never make $1 million because you look at $1 million in the smaller sense of what your life is right now, which is, well, I just have to make X amount of money every year, stack away 100, and then even 10 years, I'll have $1 million. But that's because you don't understand the process of how money's made. Like the commission on a Bugatti is $300,000. The commission on a house can be $200,000. So you can look at $1 million as I work 10 years, or you can look at $1 million as I learn in 1 year how to sell $1 million homes so I can sell 5 of them and make $1 million. So what I'm saying is, like, if you understand how money is made in the world, you can start actually understanding where you fit into the picture to make that money.
Yep. Yeah, that's crazy to think about. There's always like a different avenue and there's always like a different job for everyone to do. And obviously there's money involved because you're just trading value, really.
Yes, but you see, there is money in everything. And if every college kid in the world learns that, then they stop worrying about how do I make money. Instead, they'll worry about how do I get so good at something that I don't have to get money, but money comes to me. Because that's the question people aren't asking. They're asking, how do I make $1 million? They're not asking, how do I make $1 million come to me? And that's the big reason why they're always working for their money. Because if they are so good at something that people can't stop actually asking them to do a service, then they raise their rate enough. Then they have to hire people to do that service on their behalf. And that's how business is built. You know, it's on the idea of being so talented at something that you can streamline that talent into a process that other people pay for without you fulfilling that specific process anymore. So if other people do it, then you're still getting paid. You pay them 50%, but you're not working and you're still making all the money. And that's the idea of a real business. And that in itself isn't even entrepreneurship, but that's at least process-driven businesses that make real money and not just people buying themselves a job.
Yeah. So like, obviously you had a lot of like experience and success with your early businesses. So like, what were some of the lessons you learned like when first starting out, like building a company?
That no one gives a shit and you need to live by that. I can't stress that enough more than anything else. No one cares. So the earlier you get out of your head that people have to give a shit, that you have a good mission, you're a good guy, you're trying to make things, the earlier you get that out of your head, the earlier you start focusing on real marketing, real process, and stop worrying about what you're entitled to, what the world should be, and so on and so forth. Two, that you need more than anything else in the world, be true to your word to yourself. So I think this is one of the biggest mistakes people make, is they make a lot of promises to their customers, but they don't make promises to themselves. Like, whatever you say you're going to do, like if you say you're going to deliver something by 9 p.m., make sure by 8:59 it's delivered, even if you had to literally miss your child's birth. I'm that serious. Like, you got to commit to that level where it's like, I won't lie to myself. Therefore, if I promise someone something, I'm going to deliver. If you ingrain that shit in your head very early, you're going to be really successful. The other part is your passion doesn't have to do anything with your business. Now, it's true that if you are passionate about a business, you're going to work at it harder and longer. Absolutely. But you know what? You can also get passionate about building a process. You can get passionate about making money. These are things that are linear in every business. And so the earlier you get the idea out of your head that the only business you need to be in is businesses you love, rather than businesses whose processes you understand and can get passionate about building these processes, then that's the earlier you're going to start seeing money come in the door and not be so like hurt that the world doesn't care. Because what happens is when people are passionate about things and then they go into business not understanding process, what happens is the world doesn't give a shit, then they get hurt. They get personally hurt that like the world didn't care, nobody cared, I'm trying to help people, I'm a good trainer, I'm trying to help people be in shape, they don't want to sign up. And they think it, they take it personally, and then they give up. You know, they're like, well, this is stupid, I'm going to go do something else. They don't realize that in itself, building a business is what you need to get passionate about, more so than just the topic of the business itself.
Yeah, just like falling in love with the process, obviously. Like you said, like doing something and then finding like something to love about what you're doing, basically. And then obviously you had like a ton of experience, so like, you'd have to, like, was there failure involved at all when you were doing your businesses? And if there was, like, how did you overcome it?
Dude, failure is only when you give up. So as long as you don't give up, a pivot in a business is fine. Like, there's plenty of times where you try things and they don't work out. They aren't failures. Because you see, the thing I tell people is business is also, successful business is built on progressive knowledge. Knowledge doesn't come unless you try things. So you try something, you earn some type of knowledge about what has happened or has worked or not. You compound that learning into the next step, right? And that gives you compounding knowledge. So if you have five things that didn't work, you figured out five things that weren't working, but you also got data from those five things. Maybe one small thing in those worked. So you're going to apply that even bigger, and then you make the sixth attempt to work. So I don't believe that any of the five first ones were failures unless you gave up, right? And I think this is one of the important parts of business, to understand that if you don't compound knowledge, you're not going to compound wealth or revenue in your business. You're only going to trade knowledge for revenue, which is a huge mistake. You have to compound revenue so that there can be enough money to grow a business past just the stage of I'm starting and I'm feeding myself, my family's happy, I bought myself a nice car. All that shit is what everybody goes through at the beginning. But if you're not compounding knowledge, you're not going to be compounding wealth and revenue in your business. So that's like super important. So like, if you look at my personal failures, where I've made mistakes that I feel like, man, I wish I wouldn't have made that. A lot of my businesses early on relied on my loyalty towards my employees, you know, like, and towards my partners. It was always like at the beginning, where it was all about like, listen, I want us to finish this together. You know, we started this together. We are together, and we're going to make it together. But I always use NSYNC or some of these examples as a good, like these boy bands and some of these guys that started like the Beyonces of the world, right? They got to a place where they realized that the work ethic and the way they were moving forward was exceeding their capacity at the moment, which were the people that were around them. And they had to make that tough choice to, it's not a question of loyalty, it's to say, if I stay here, then I'm only limited to what this group can do. If I go on my own, I can not only continue this group, but I can also expand to more. Now, there is a risk that they lost the group, right? Destiny's Child is gone, Beyonce was born, you know, and the same with NSYNC, but Justin Timberlake is still there, right? And he's into movies, he's into all of these things and everything else, and we don't hear a lot about the other NSYNC guys. And so the point is that you have to be willing to make these choices earlier than later in your business. And I think in my own businesses, a lot of times I wanted to hang on to the group. You know, I wanted to hang on to the original base, to the original people, because I felt a sense of loyalty towards them that, you know, like if I don't do it with them, they were there through the hard times. They should be there through the success, you know? But at the same time, I thought, what if they're damaging to the success, right? What if because of them, we can't get where we're trying to go? So the earlier you give that up, the earlier you focus on growth and no longer on where you are, like the business. And one other thing I'll leave you with, which I think is very important, a big mistake I made and a lot of people make when they go in business at first, is when you have a job, like I had a very good paying job, right? And so when I went into my first business, which was VIP Motoring, which was my own financial firm after banking that established alternative asset management for cars, watches, and everything, I used to have in my mind that I'm getting paid $250,000 a year at the bank. You know, that's what I was making. And I had my bonus that sometimes was seven figure, sometimes was six figure. So let's say on an average, I made, let's say $500,000, right, in a given year. I would think like, wow, the first order of business for my business is to make me $500,000 so I can survive, right? Because I was making half, I want to make half. So I'm like, boom, I'm at least where I was. And that is the biggest mistake a business owner can make. Your new business has no correlation with your old job. There is no reason you should try to set a goal to match your salary at a job that had no correlation with a business in a different field. So your business has a cap and a growth rate based on what it is. It has no correlation at all of what your salary was. And so by separating the two early and removing this idea that you're only as good as the salary you used to make as a baseline, you are able to completely free your mind from that very basic limitation and focus your business on making the most revenue so that you can bring back and say, how do I effectively take home the most profits? And not so much like, how do I get paid $250,000 a year so I can, you know, pay my mortgage and my two cars and feel good about my life, you know?
Wow. Yeah, it's like basically just finding like a dichotomy between like those certain things.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense, you know? But so many people do it. I'm sure you've heard of like people that are like, hey, I got fired. I just have to find a business that pays me $100,000 a year, you know, so that I can have my mortgage and I can be okay. And it's not saying that you can't at least have some kind of monetary goal. But you shouldn't have a goal. You should rather have an expectation to make a minimum of 100,000 rather than a goal to make 100,000.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be based on prior experience because it just has nothing
to do. Correct, because it's irrelevant. You know?
Wow. So you touched on the secret entourage earlier. I just want to know how you came up with the idea for that, and then how did you get started with it?
So Secret Entourage was a passion project. You see, I had my business that was in Virginia that still is called VIP Motoring. That became a very big business. At the time, it was doing like $40 million a year in revenue. It was pretty decent. It wasn't like, and let me correct something real quick, because like you get impressed when you hear like $30 million, $40 million, $100 million. Like it's like cock sizes for like horses. Like you got a 14-inch cock and a 12-inch cock, right? It doesn't make a difference. I'm just being honest. Like here's the reality of business that people aren't talking about. If I tell you right now my business, VIP Motoring, is making $80 million a year in Virginia, that means I gotta be fucking loaded, right? Like, because that's a lot of money. But just because a business makes $80 million of revenue doesn't mean I'm fucking taking home $75 million of it, yep. Right? There is inventory, there's overhead. Technically, you're gonna laugh at this. That $80 million business makes me less than $3 million in profits a year, which pays me a little bit under $1 million personally as a salary. How fucked is that, right? Yeah. Like, you're not excited if I tell you I make $800,000 a year. But you get excited when you hear $80 million a year. So first rule of business, never fall for the revenue bullshit because it doesn't matter. Now, here's the funny part. My other business online makes $5 million a year, pays me $4.5 million of it in profit in my pocket. So which business do you want to own? The one that fucking looks good on Instagram? That's like, guys, I'm doing $100 million a year. My cock is like 14 inches long. Everybody should come and be my friend. Or the business that says, hey, listen, my cock ain't that big, but I know how to use it. And 10 inches is enough to make me enough to do whatever I want. So what I'm saying is, the point is that you shouldn't fall in love with revenue numbers ever. Fall in love with the money in your pocket, not the money that's on the sheets, right? And then to answer your question, sorry, I got off topic there. We started completely going. off the cuff. But okay, so Secret Entourage, at some point when I started making a lot of money in my business, I wanted to answer this very simple question. What happens if I got hit by a car tomorrow and died? And reality was that I was just the asshole in town that made a lot of money, had a lot of cars, and was the guy that was known as the car guy. Like, I was the guy with the Lamborghini, showed up to the club, parked up front, that jackass, you know, the guy that nobody likes in the yellow car. That's like, why is that guy not waiting in line like everybody else? Why is that guy being a dick and like just walking in with like three girls when he's got a two-seater? It doesn't even make sense, man, right? It's stupid. But when you're a kid, you think that shit's cool, which is okay. I thought that was cool too. So I was doing it. It was awesome. But then I started realizing that when I was walking past that line, everybody was like, oh, it's that same guy that comes here every week. And I started realizing, what if I died tomorrow? Would I want people to say I was the jackass that came in the club? Like, is that really cool? Was I was the jackass that had a Lamborghini? Like, how fucking retarded is that, right? It was so dumb. And then I started thinking about my mom's commitment to life and all the times she sacrificed her well-being for me to be here, like meaning to be in a position to even be in a car like that. And I thought to myself, I said, is her legacy going to end with someone thinking her son was a jackass who just came here and just had nice cars and made some money and whatever? So I started thinking, what are the reasons why I've been really successful in my life? What is my core talent? And I realized that my core talent was teaching. And so I wanted to become a teacher. And I realized that I was really good at it. But I realized that being a teacher wouldn't pay me anything. So I didn't want to go into kindergarten and work to teach what others told me to teach. I wanted to teach what I wanted to teach. And so I started at the time as a joke, a blog called Secret Consulting, which was nothing more than just writing success tips and everything, because I got tired of people asking me, what do you do for a living? How come you're so young in these cars? And so I created this blog and I just started writing stuff. Then people really liked it and they were reading it. So I started putting more effort towards it. And I started, because I was tired of just talking about myself, I started asking my other friends who had nice cars, like, hey, can you like talk to me about what you do for a living? Like literally what you guys are doing right now. I was doing that 11 years ago, right? When nobody was fucking talking about anything. And I started doing it in a blog format, you know, and at the time, no, we didn't have podcasts and shit. That wasn't the way we did stuff then. But we had, you know, I was doing a blog. I was doing some basic video Skype interviews when Skype would cut out every 3 minutes because it sucks, you know, like. And so basically, I was doing whatever I had to get the stories of these people that were not famous. You know, Instagram wasn't a thing. All these things weren't out there. So people really didn't know who was who. And so I connected them to like, look, these people are successful and they're never on TV. You've never heard of them. But they have the life you want. So here's how they did it. And people started really resonating with that and they watched. And then it grew so big that I didn't have a way to monetize it. You know, like meaning because it was getting actually costly to run it. And it was a passion project. So I decided that I would literally create a revenue model for it because I was good in business that would allow it not only to support itself, support its growth, and continue becoming a global force for making entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial education affordable to all. You see, my thing was that I believed, I never read a book in my life. This is a fact, something that we should have done in Two Truths and a Lie, right? Which I don't know why I didn't think about that. But I never read a book in my life because I hate reading. It's not that it's bad to read, I just hate reading. I can't get into a book. So I've never ever read one. I've read excerpts from a book, but I can't read. That's why I also sucked in school. But the point is that one of the ways I've learned growing up was that I wasn't afraid to ask people for 30 minutes of their time for coffee. Like when I had customers at the bank that were just rich customers, I would be like, let me buy you coffee and you tell me your story. And by learning their story, I would learn their industries. By learning their industries, I understood the flow of money in completely unrelated industries. And so one thing that happened is I didn't get smarter. I got more aware and alert of how money flowed. And so one of the things I promised myself I would do when I made enough money was to build that same opportunity for people who perhaps are not in places that they have access to rich people, they have access to their neighbor to talk to and 60 other people. They don't have Ferraris, they have Ferrari friends, you know, and so on and so forth. So the point was, I created a model that allowed someone to literally join Secret Entourage and spend 30 minutes a day, a week, however way they want it, and sit with one random person that is way more successful than them and just talk to them. Like they're not really talking, I'm talking to them on their behalf and they're in the first person perspective having a conversation with that person. And as a result of that, they're ultimately just winning because they're getting the same exposure I got. Except it's even better than me because mine was random and theirs is actually like, oh, I want to learn about real estate. I'd like to know about IT. I'd like to know about, you know, clothing brands. And a lot of the things, the brands they use are in there, like Movement Watches. You know, the guys that created these watches, whatever, Jake and I think Charlie, they ended up, they started because of Secret Entourage. And so it's incredible to see like how immature they were when they started and now how much more they've matured into a $100 million brand, right? It's a big deal to watch that that can happen in 5 years. It's a big deal to believe that can happen. And that's what I hope to give people with Secret Entourage for the last 11 years. And what's interesting, it's the project that takes the most time out of my day and it's the one that pays me absolutely nothing year after year.
Wow.
Yeah,
but
is it the most
passionate project?
Is it the most like fulfilling to you?
No, you know, actually it made me open my life to how dumb the world is because by teaching so many people, I unfortunately am now exposed to how disconnected people are from reality. So it's even made me more determined to help so many people who want to be helped and not help those that are cartoons. You know, like when I started Secret, my goal was to help the world, right? Like I was like, I want to help everybody. Now, as I progressed through the 11 years, I've focused on helping the few that will change the masses. Does that make sense? And not rather change the masses. So it's a different approach to it, but nonetheless, I think it's a very powerful project that's needed no matter how much I like or dislike certain aspects of it, you know?
Yep, right. That's incredible. So I want to go back to the online business you have that you said, like, you take home mm-hmm. like 80% of the profit. Like, how do you start that up and make it successful and make it humble?
Well, I spent 11 years with Secret, right? So I learned everything about internet marketing. I learned everything about selling infomercial products, you know, and everything else. So because I never wanted to make Secret Entourage about money for me, it was never about that. So I never wanted to charge a lot of money, have upsells for huge amounts of money or anything that would make it hard for kids or people to have access to this information. I also am a businessman, I'm a capitalist in the sense that I believe in the fact that evolution is key. So I had a lot of compounding knowledge, right? And it doesn't mean the knowledge has to apply to my business. So I established two other businesses, Exotic Car Hacks and Watch Conspiracy, where one of them is a teaching platform where I teach people how to trade watches. Like, so I have the world's only watches trading academy. So it's like trading stocks, except I trade watches. It's safer, it's better, and there's more profit in it. And then the other side is I teach people exotic car hacks, which is ultimately the ability to minimize your costs through luxury lifestyle. So what happens is people are consumers of these things, and I teach them how to be exotic car investors and watch traders instead of consumers of the goods, right? The important thing to understand is that these are not random businesses. This is what my larger firm, the one I was telling you makes $80 million a year, that firm is in Washington, D.C. in Virginia, and that's what it makes its money doing, is doing that for a very select few people. You know, so we manage their alternative assets, which are watches, cars, paintings, and everything else. So we do so, and now we've created the online model for people to do it themselves at home. So if you don't have 400 cars in your collection or you don't have $1 billion to spend on alternative assets, but you want to buy one car, one watch, and you want to do it the right way, you can take my courses and learn how to use your money intelligently and still have the things you want without losing money. It's very appealing to a lot of people, regardless that they're buying a car or that they're learning to do 3-4 cars at a time or they want to maximize their money. As a result of that, all the knowledge I've learned in marketing for Secret Entourage has now been applied to exotic car hacks and watch conspiracy. And here's the funny part. Those, because they are for money platforms, meaning I've built them to make money, these platforms have quadrupled Secret Entourage's revenue. In the 11 years Secret has been around, these platforms in 2 years have quadrupled the revenue that Secret makes. Wow. So each of them, not together. So ultimately they are so hard that, I mean, in a good way, you know, they're doing so well that it's just impossible for me to now almost give up Secret because in a way I've handcuffed myself to the online model, forcing myself to continue my passion project even at times when I'm down. And you see, this is so important that you don't have to love what you do all the time. That's what I was saying earlier, right? There's years where I love Secret to death and I love helping people. And there's years where I get very down, you know, and annoyed that people aren't getting it faster. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing this for? If people aren't really, you know, that's what I was telling you earlier. You know, I want to help people. People don't want to help themselves, and you can't take it personally, you know? And by allowing these three platforms to work like a tripod, I've ultimately prevented myself from quitting, knowing that it's harder and harder to do what I wanted to do before, you know? I mean, look at the digital age we live in now. What you guys are doing, what, how many podcasts are out there doing business? Thousands, you know? Like, even the people I've interviewed that are actually my friends have now started competing businesses. So think about that. Like, that's, isn't that fucked up in a way? Like, you've given them the spotlight, and now they're fucking you? Like, but what I'm saying is, that's okay, because if I take it personally, then I'm pissed. But if I look at it as a true business guy, it's life. You can't be afraid of competition. You have to stick to what you do, and you have to understand that the value you provide the market is different than the value they'll provide the market. And while it is true that I may lose customers, it is true that I may lose people that may flock over there because it's the new shiny toy, it doesn't matter, because your intention in business is just as important as your process. And my intention was to help people. It isn't always, the process is not always as easy as I want it to be doing so.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like a lot of people get discouraged from starting a business because I feel like there's a ton of competition in like the same field. But I feel like if you just differentiate yourself and provide value that no one else can, then you'll be.
And do you really have to differentiate yourself? Ask yourself that. How many fucking phone stores sell Apple iPhones?
Yeah.
Five.
Like, and the next guy's like, I'm going to start another cell phone store. And you're like, oh, well, that's never going to work. And then they're like, oh, well, we're still making $2 million a year. Yeah. Fine. It's not going to be the next Apple, but
yeah.
Yeah,
you know, if you open 10 of them, you're still going to do well.
Yeah.
One of our previous interviews said, like, you don't have to stir the whole ocean. You just have to stir a pot and then stir a couple more pots. And then eventually.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have. This is the thing. A lot of people think, look, entrepreneurship is disruptive. Business doesn't have to be. Business is simple. It's the art of facilitating transactions. Like, that's it. It's the art of figuring out how to connect a buyer and a seller and the process that comes in between. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be, you could literally have a progressive coffee shop in mind just because you have a location. So the location can be the competitive advantage, not the actual serving fucking coffee. Like, it's coffee. Like, how fucked can you make cocaine in a liquid format? You know, like, it's the same thing no matter what. I mean, it's the same shit, right? Cocaine is cocaine, no matter you liquefy it or put more fucking sugar in it or not. It's the same thing. So at the end of the day, like, coffee is coffee. Now, yes, one of them tastes more like awesomeness. The other one tastes like this. But at the end of the day, if you're decent in making your coffee, people will drink it. But if you have a great location, it's more likely they're going to try it. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that the disruption does not have to happen in the business model. So many young people confuse disruption with the whole idea of, I got to re-engineer the space. You know, they look at it as like, I got to be Elon Musk. Well, fuck, Elon Musk didn't start as Elon Musk. He started as a nerdy motherfucker that was coding shit, and then he started coding shit with 10 other people. Then PayPal comes along, you know, and then one thing leads to another. It's compounding knowledge, and you can't expect to compete with someone who's compounded 30 years of knowledge because you're fucking bright and creative. You're not going to compete with that person. So what you need to do is come into the space, facilitate transactions, get really good at it, and allow your own compounding to happen at a faster rate than the next person because you have access to more knowledge. So I tell people, don't try to be me today. Try to do what I've done in 20 years in 5 years. That's true success, you know, because you have more information than I did and you have more knowledge than I can have.
That makes a lot of sense.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. All right. So last question before we get into a lightning round real quick, then we'll be out of here. So from my understanding, you published a book before you ever read a book, because you said that you
mm-hmm.
How did you, you wrote a book without reading one. How's it even possible?
So you want to hear something really fucked up? I actually wrote 12 books. Did you know that?
No.
You see, that's why it's fucked up, because 10 of them went unread by people like you.
Right.
But look, this is the truth, man. This is how fucked the world is. I had to write 10 fucking books so that you don't read it, so that I have to keep writing a fucking 11th so I can sell a million copies of that 11th. If I wouldn't have written 10 books, I would have never written 11 one. What I'm trying to tell you is, and here's the fucked up part. After I wrote the 11 one, I thought it was so easy. Now all I have to do is write a 12 one and I'll automatically sell a million copies because people loved it. Wrong. Nope. 12 book came out, first day, 500 copies. I'm sitting there holding my dick in my hand like, you gotta be joking. Like 500 fucking books to a million? Like, what the fuck? Are you people sleeping? Like, you say it's the best book you ever read, you won't read the sequel? What the fuck? Yeah. But this is the reality of business. The second book needed the same level of marketing as the first book. And just because I had a following didn't mean it was automatic, like, done. You know, it still required to work. And yes, I wrote the 12 books not reading a book. Why or how? Simply by putting my thoughts on paper and taking the 10 books as a practice round to how to truly formulate a unique formula that was not just repeating what's in the marketplace out there. So the reason my books didn't work before my 11 one is because they weren't authentic to me and because I didn't have experience writing books. So while the content may have been very valuable, it also wasn't authentic to, like, I had learned it somewhere. So I was only sharing what I had learned and what I had done, right? But my 11th book was really, it's called Third Circle Theory. It's my most famous book. And it was really the book that defined my own mind that nobody can take from me. So meaning like my process that nobody else knows, you know, that's why it became successful because people would read it and be like, oh, I get it. Like, I've never read that this way, you know? So what he's sharing is unique. And as a result of it, my life is better by reading it. And so, you know, was it luck? Some of it, you know, yeah. I mean, I didn't have a formula that by 11th was mastered, but I had understood what 10 books that didn't work looked like, meaning they didn't catch for people, you know? And I knew that what the 10 mistakes were I made that I wasn't going to repeat with number 11, you know?
Wow. Yeah. That's really cool, actually.
I mean, isn't that like simple as shit, but really fucked up that I had to write 10 to get to 11?
Simple.
Like, I mean, think about it. Like, it's simple when you think about it, right? Write 10 books, let them get fucked up, and write 11. That's a good one. But it's so much work when you actually think about it.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like, I can't even put that into perspective, like writing that many. But props to you.
And I hate writing. I hate reading. I hate writing. Like, I can't stand that shit. I would have made a movie if I could, but I didn't have the money to make a $20 million Hollywood movie just to watch it go to shit, you know?
That'd be sick, right? If you actually do that in the future. We'll be looking out for it.
You never know, man.
Yeah. So we're going to do
it later. I'm actually going to be, I'm going to be on Netflix in September. I was in the show, Fastest Car Racing, like for, you know, the fastest car in the US, whatever.
Oh, really?
So you're going to see me in that show and you're going to laugh your ass off because in my other life, I'm pretty sure I was a comedian at some point. Because I'm pretty, like, doing some really epic, retarded shit, but it'll be fun. Good television, you know? Hopefully, they'll bring me back for something else later, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. So, we're just going to wrap up with the lightning round. And the first question is just, like, if you could sit down with your 18-year-old self for 10, 15 seconds, what would you say?
I would say commit to the trade, not the money.
Awesome. What's the worst advice you've ever received? And then what's the best advice you've ever received?
The worst advice I've ever received is that you have to have $1 million to live like $1 million, and you should always live within your means. I think it's the worst advice I've ever received because I believe that you should push yourself to put yourself in environments that you do not have access to, only to know what life is like. If you are afraid to buy, like if you're a woman, you're afraid to buy yourself $1,000 pair of shoes, because you only have $5,000 to your name, you will never be in a position to understand how small your life is, that it's that insignificant that you're not buying yourself a pair of shoes. Instead, buy yourself the fucking shoes and level up to figure out how to be in a position to buy another 10 pairs in the next 6 weeks. You know, like, don't fall back to your goals. Push yourself up to actually reaching them, you know? Don't settle for life. Push yourself to attain the life you want. That's my, the worst piece of advice I've received and why, you know, so I've explained it. The best piece of advice I've received from anybody, actually, have I ever received fucking advice from anybody? Nobody gave a shit about me when I was growing up. So, no, I think one of the things that my mom's always taught me is your word, is the most important thing you have because no one can tell you what to say and no one can take it away from you. So if you don't commit to your word, you'll never commit to yourself.
Damn. Yeah, those are both great, great answers. And then the last one is, like, what would you put on a billboard for the whole world to see? Like a quote, image, saying, anything.
Man, that's a tough one.
This is your chance to actually matter.
All right. No, I think I've said that. That's how I end all of my books, is he who masters himself will always master the world. And I think this is so important that it's so difficult for young people with the revolution we're in when it comes to information. You guys get so much information from Instagram, Facebook, you know, news outlets and everything that we didn't have. You, as a result of that information, go further and further and further away from mastering yourself and focus on external factors a lot more than internal. The journey to self-mastery is the single hardest thing you will ever do in your life, but it is also one that will make sure that the rest of your life, from the day you do so, will never, ever, ever be lived in fear, anxiety, or in the lack of opportunity of seeing the destinations you seek in life and how to reach them. And I know it sounds philosophical, but just trust me in this. What most young people don't have in life is a destination, and they don't have that destination because they don't know themselves enough to know what they're capable of. So if you can master the two, like to master yourself enough to be confident in the destinations you set, no matter how small or large, and be willing to commit to them, you will always find success in life, no matter at what age or time frame you start.
Wow. That's a great way to wrap it up, dude.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Anything else I can do for you, gentlemen?
A little bit. No, that was, I really appreciate the time, man. That was great.
My pleasure. Did you guys get anything you want? I mean, I don't really do tricks or anything, but if we're doing something else.
No, I think we'll have to wait for the Netflix to see.
All right, buddy. Well, let me know if you need anything else, or ask Andrew if you need any collateral, you know, images, anything, whatever I can do. And whenever you guys have it, send it to me. I'll share it all over. We have like, I think, a million over like our 5 Instagram accounts. So wow. I'll be happy to share it for you as much as I can. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, appreciate the time, man. That was awesome.
All right. Take care, guys. Be well.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hey guys, show some love for the Real Talk University podcast by subscribing and leaving a review on the Apple Podcast app. See you all next week.